Welcome, everybody, to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber, and today's interview is with someone we're coming to think of as a colleague at the Hall of Fame. After a career that saw her reach Grand Slam finals very young and eventually finish with four major singles titles, three of them as a mom, two major doubles titles, and a Fed Cup winner's medal, our guest is now giving back to the sport as the honorary president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. She was also one of the most likable players on the international circuit, often playing with a smile on her face and clear joy in her heart. She is, of course, Kim Clijsters.
Tennis started as something that I love to do, and so to have fun out on court is something that was super important for me. There's no 80%, there's no 50, like it's 100% in everything that I used to do on the tennis court and in my fitness. I don't think about legacy, I am in the moment and I try to create the best out of it and how I can give back to a sport that has given me so many incredible feelings and memories.
I had the pleasure of spending a day with her on the eve of the annual enshrinement ceremonies at Newport, Rhode Island. And that included sitting down with microphones and chatting about what makes a successful person. Kim, welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
This podcast focuses to a degree on the ingredients that go into making a champion and your road to being a Hall of Famer. Talent versus hard work, which plays a bigger role?
It's always a tough question, right? Because there's that saying, if talent doesn't work hard, or hard work beats talent, if talent doesn't work hard. And it's important. Obviously, working hard is something that is very important. But I think for professional athletes, it's a lifestyle to work hard. And I've seen it is important to work hard, but to work smart. And I've seen so many players, you know, even in my academy, even some, you know, players that I help out now, and they almost feel like the harder I work and the more I do, the better I will get. And it almost has the opposite effect on how they, you know, develop their game and develop their mental state of mind. And so it's, you know, for me, it was really important that when I got older to learn to switch off my tennis brain, because when you're a professional athlete, everywhere you go, everything you do, you think tennis all the time and you get confronted with it. And so to learn to switch it off has been, and then to switch it on at the right time has been the biggest. I've seen more kids get burned out, mm-hmm. and I've seen players when I was on juniors that were supposed to be these big new stars in sport, and from the moment that, you know, they leave the juniors and they have a little bit of freedom, they completely lose every sense of, you know, all the discipline that they learned because they have a sense of a little bit of freedom. And mm-hmm. and so it's about, you know, tennis is a sport where early on everybody always asks you, your coach, your parents, it's how did that feel? How did that shot feel that you missed at the bottom of the net? Or how is that serve that where you just hit that ace? Remember how that feels. So it's really important, and I feel very lucky that I had a father who was a professional athlete, that to learn how I feel. It's the reason why I retired in 2000 and when I was 25, because I couldn't be committed anymore to the sport, to give everything that I have, to work hard, to be dedicated, and because I wanted to start a family. That was a life goal of mine as well, and I listened to that. And there's so many women, especially in that time when I came back after I had Jada, who came up to me and they said, I wish I was able to do what you did. I am so stuck with keeping track of the points that I need to defend and the prize money that I try to, you know, get to. And it's hard. I mean, for some to, you know, when tennis is the only thing you have, it's scary to go away from that.
Since you retired for the first time when you were quite young, relatively speaking, mm-hmm. you had Jada and then came back. Did you find that the priorities that you felt internally were cyclical, that obviously as a very young athlete, tennis was your focus, and then you felt an imperative to start a family because mm-hmm. that's something you aspire to? And then after you established that for a period of time, talk about the mindset that inspired you to come back for the first time.
So it all started, so I lost in 2009, was actually the year that I won the US Open in September, but I lost my father on January 4th, and he was sick for a year. It was a very intense year where we, you know, we were with him every day. And so there's life lessons that you go through that don't have anything to do with tennis, but that do change you know, how you look at anything else that happens in your life from there onwards. And so for me, that was a huge life-changing experience. It was a negative one, but there were so many beautiful moments in that last year of my father's life as well. And so after he passed away, a few weeks later, I got a letter in the mail from Wimbledon, and they invited me to go to play at the opening of the new center court where they built the roof, and the invitation said that I would be able to play with Tim Henman against Steffi Graf and Andre Agassi. Mm. So for me, you know, Steffi and Andre were, you know, my childhood heroes. I got, you know, an Andre Agassi in the women's version, the denim skirt with the fluo kind of yellow bike pants under it. Like, those were, you know, Christmas presents in our household.
Those are cool.
And so for me, you know, going through that stage and kind of needing, after a tough year, needing some kind of excitement and some different goals, it was really, really exciting. So I committed to that and started hitting, and then the hunger to play tennis and to compete grew bigger and bigger, and kept my emotions in for a little bit. Didn't want to tell anybody, didn't want to share my thoughts, because I was just wondering, is this going to be over in 2 weeks or in a couple of weeks? And then it just grew stronger. Told my team that I was working with before, and we decided to, and this is the crazy thing about it, we decided that the two lead-up tournaments to the US Open and the US Open, I was going to play three tournaments in 2009 so that I could kind of get a feel for what it's like to travel with a baby on tour with a family and just to see what it's like. And I think not having any expectation and being so excited to go out to play again, and it was, I think that's the main reason why I was able to win and to hold up the trophy at the end of those 2 weeks.
2009 is what we're talking about. Yeah. It was Serena in the semifinals. It was Wozniacki in the final. Mm-hmm. You needed a wild card to get into the draw. You said that you just used the phrase no expectations. Was it truly no expectations?
Yeah, it was. I mean, there was a moment, I think I lost to Jelena Jankovic, who I think, if I might be wrong, but I think she was number one at the time, or top three at least. I think she was number one. And I lost to her in Canada, I think, in one of the lead-up tournaments. And I lost 7-5 in the third, but I was still a little bit rusty. But I did feel like, okay, if I get my kind of, you know, normal routines back in place, I could beat her. And so I remember my trainer, Sam, he was stretching me after that match. And I was never somebody to say to be overly confident and say, like, oh, I'm going to beat her, I'm going to do this. But I said, as he's stretching my hamstrings and he's kind of leaning over me, I tell him, I say, Sam, I think I can win the US Open. And he's like, whoa, like, hold on a second. You know, like, let's not focus on that right now. Like, it's still a long way to go. And I said, I understand that. But I do feel that I'm close to these players again. And
you ever felt that sort of confidence
Never.
In your first incarnation?
Never.
Never really?
Never. Never. There was always some doubt in my mind, which is the reason why it took me so long, I think, also to be able to win my first Grand Slam, because I didn't feel that I was good enough, like, as Justine in those finals, playing Jennifer Capriati. I was very young, but I didn't believe that I could win. And knowing what I know now, I'm very happy that I wasn't, you know, like, let's say, like how Emma in her situation right now is, when you win a Grand Slam so early, and I said it many times before, I'm happy I wasn't, you know, a Grand Slam champion at the age of 17 or 18.
You were not an overnight success.
No, I wasn't, but I wouldn't have been able to handle it mentally, because I was not ready for everything that gets thrown at you in that kind of circus.
And so when you ended up winning majors 2, 3, and 4 post comeback, was there an aspect of, well, man, I've experienced life without tennis. I've walked away from it once in a way. This is bonus time for me. Was that at all part of your feeling?
I think I never really looked back. Obviously, after having Jada and you know, I had a lot of data to kind of compare to, or where I wanted to, you know, levels that I wanted to reach fitness-wise, or if it was weight or whatever it was. There was levels, serve speed. There were so many things that I could try to get back to. But once I started playing, I don't feel like I was thinking a lot. There's, you know, once you get on court, and even now where I'm, you know, not training much at all, and but when I get into a match or if there's some certain routines in your that are stuck in your mind that get you, you know, right there, focused.
Give, and, give me an example.
Little routines, little superstitious things that at Wimbledon now, you know, there is going to the same bathroom. That those were little things that you, the same shower, packing your bag a certain way, walking on court, trying not to step on the lines. I mean, there's certain things that automatically, when I'm practicing in an indoor facility in New Jersey, I don't do that. But when you, all of a sudden, you play it at center court of Wimbledon, and you want to sit in the same seat. You want to, and Martina, she was my partner, Martina Hingis, and we both had that. It's funny how when you get to that, you it's in there. It's saved in our brain, and of course our reactions aren't as quick as they used to be, and we don't move as fast. But the routines and our way of thinking on the court is still very much the same.
Tennis can be a solitary pursuit. There's nobody to tag in for you. There's no clock to stop it. And you're out there trying to problem solve on your own, except when you're playing doubles and you also won a couple of doubles slams. Did you, obviously, the greatest glory, it seems, comes from singles, but did you cherish your doubles time and being part of a team?
Very much. Loved it. I especially early on in my career, I played with Ai Sugiyama from Japan, and we had a blast. I mean, we loved practicing together. We loved going out to dinners together. It was, she was my buddy on tour, and it's something that, you know, you don't think about a lot, is that when you're so young and you start living life on tour, it's, you know, your social life isn't what, you know, every other teenager experiences, right? It's hard to build really good friendships with some of these players that are your rivals at times as well, and who have their own teams and their own schedules. And so for me, having, you know, playing doubles and you know, Ai's mom, you know, making me rice balls, you know, before certain matches,
and
rice balls, and she would fill them with salmon, or there was always something else, and she was, it was just so nice to be a part of like a team where, you know, we understood each other, we respected each other, but we got along together really well, and then I came to a point where, okay, you know, doubles is taking away a little bit of my goals and ambitions in singles, so I had to make a decision. But I mean, even when if I wasn't, you know, playing doubles, I still loved to play mixed doubles, and I played with a couple of the Belgian guys, with Melisse and with Rokas, and so to be able to, have that experience and laugh and have fun, to me, it was always, tennis started as something that I loved to do, and so to have fun out on court is something that was super important for me.
You mentioned Justine earlier, obviously a rivalry there. Did you ever think about how remarkable that this small country, at roughly the same time, produced these two remarkable champions? I mean, you see it in Serbia now, where it's such a small country and it's producing an inordinate number of champions. What an amazing time for Belgian women's tennis.
Yeah, incredible. And to me, you know, having Justine, and not when we were on tour, but even before that, she was a year older than me, but she was from the French side, I was from the Flemish side, but we always, you know, came together in the bigger tournaments in Belgium first, and then we got to play on the same team when we played for our country, and under 14s and under 16s. And so having experienced, you know, sharing a room together and us trying to get along, not knowing which language should we speak, you know, my French wasn't great, her Flemish wasn't great. So trying to get along, and so it was very interesting. And we played together, we traveled together, you know, saw some of our struggles, you know, after her mom passed away. I was at a tournament with her only a few weeks later. There's connections that you build with somebody that goes so much further beyond tennis, that, you know, even when I lost a Grand Slam final against her, of course I was disappointed, and I was more mad at myself that I wasn't able to compete at a high level at that moment. But then when I see her holding up the trophy, and like, there's a part of me that was also happy for her. Yeah. And I guess it's just a human side of life, right? That it's, so important.
Even with the women who were your most fierce rivals during your playing career, do you find a certain camaraderie now, even more so than when you were playing? Because, gosh, can you believe all that we went through and to arrive here and come through the other side.
And I think I realized that the most after I retired. And you know, you build new friendships with people and with mothers that you meet at the school gate or birthday parties. And you realize, like, you don't have a lot of things in common with a lot of the women who've gone through, you know, high school, university, whatever, college. And besides the fact that we are parents and mothers, there's not a lot of similarities in our lives. And then when you come to, you know, even now when you go play Legends, or when you go, you know, we go back to the Hall of Fame, and just to see a lot of the players that you used to compete against and that you have tough rivalries with, but there's a connection, and it goes, there's not a lot of people who will understand what we've gone through and the struggles and the ups and downs, and it's very, very special, and it feels like home in a sense, right? Because these players, you have a connection with somebody who's gone through the same things and who knows exactly what it takes to get there.
Do you think that has something to do with the reason that you were drawn to Brian, because he was a professional athlete and can understand to at least some degree what you went through?
Definitely. To some degree, he did not know anything about tennis, so which was also very refreshing. You know, definitely for Justine and myself when we played each other, I guess the first French Open in the semis, and Belgium was kind of turned upside down for such a small country, and a huge life-changing moment, kind of from one week to the other, where just being recognized and the attention that was on us was crazy. So for me to then all of a sudden meet an American in my hometown in Belgium that has about 10,000 people who had no clue who I was, didn't really follow tennis. The only person he knew was Anna Kournikova. So it was very refreshing to me. And my connection to the United States has always been great. It's been great on the court. I loved traveling to America and the meeting people, and I've met friends throughout the years on tour. And now to live in the States, it feels good. I enjoy living here. I enjoy how our kids can grow up here and that they can play sports. And in Belgium, it's still, sports is still being looked at as, especially for kids, like, okay, no, first do your school, and then you can have your hobby in sports. I love the fact that here in the States, whatever a kid's talent is, they get a chance to develop it in school, and a lot of teachers support it.
You talked earlier about your upbringing as an athletic child, and now you have children who compete in sports. In general terms, if you had to give one sort of overarching piece of advice from what you've learned to sports parents, what would that be?
It's to find a good balance. I feel very lucky that I had a dad who, my father played a few World Cups in soccer, and he was not very well known in Belgium when it comes to soccer. And just to learn from him as an athlete, and he was the one who would tell me in the beginning when I came on tour, I would have played 40 tournaments a year if I could, right? Yeah. I was so excited, and I couldn't wait to get back on the plane and to kind of, my mom would help me kind of rewash all the dirty laundry and pack the suitcase up again and fly off to the next place. But my dad was the one who would tell me, no, leave your tennis bag in the garage for 5 days. Mm. Go with your friends, go to the movies, take your sister, go to the fair, whatever it was, and enjoy that. And so then, it's also a little bit of my mindset of when I go out on court, I give everything I have. There's no 80%, there's no 50, like it's 100% in everything that I used to do on the tennis court and in my fitness. So it was really important for me to take a break from it all and to mentally not be too overwhelmed by it all. And he understood that before I even understood it. And so I think it's really important to balance and to understand. And I think, our sport has, the physical and the mental side of our sport has, the attention on it has improved a lot. There's so many more, details and science behind it, that to learn to take a break and to rest is at times just as important as always keep going. And so it was, he taught me that from a very young age already.
I want to circle back to your role as the honorary president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. That's a big bite to take in this sport. What inspired you to do that, and what are you thinking about accomplishing?
I think the inspiration behind it started when I got inducted myself in 2017 and seeing, you know, it was a busy weekend, but a very, like, an overwhelming weekend. But at the same time, just seeing the Hall of Fame kind of team and how everybody kind of is so passionate about our sport, it was really exciting to be a part of it, and in that way, and then to now be able to have a small part in seeing other people get inducted and help the International Tennis Hall of Fame grow and achieve new levels that, you know, they've been talking about for a long time, and try to get it more international and try to involve some youngsters and so many things that we're trying to attack, and to be a part of that. And like I said, tennis has been such a big part, and I want to give back. I want to be a part of an organization who does it the right way. And I live in New Jersey now as well, so it's easier for me to come up here if I'm needed up here.
That's right. You're practically local. Having never been inducted into the Hall of Fame, I've only been able to watch as an outsider on the fringe of the ceremony each year. What do you remember from the day and the weekend? Is it a blur, or do you have sort of snapshots that stick in your mind?
There's snapshots that stick into my mind that I remember very strongly. And I think having played on tour for many years, it's you learn to do that a little bit. You learn to be in the moment. There's times where, you know, life on tour goes so quickly. And I feel like when I got here that weekend, it was, you know, you meet so many people, and it's hard to remember everybody that you met during those few days that you're here. But at the same time, there's emotions and experiences that you go through that stick to me to this day. So walking through the museum and seeing, mm-hmm. you know, my childhood heroes, and then all of a sudden seeing my pictures up there and doing that with my family. So it's those are very, very intense moments to live and something you'd never think about. You know, when you're a tennis player, you hope one day you get to, you know, play against Steffi Graf or play in a Grand Slam, but I never thought about, you know, these kind of moments where you feel so proud of your whole career and everything that you've achieved, and it's incredible.
What was it like to be inducted that year with Andy Roddick? Because you guys have a connection that goes way back to juniors, right?
We do. We used to play juniors together, and I've seen him develop and see him win, you know, his Grand Slam in New York. And you know, there's so many players out on tour, but when you have a connection with somebody like that that goes, you know, way back, it's really exciting. So I couldn't be more happy when I saw that we were going to be inducted together. Yeah, still to this day, he's, you know, he's a friend, and he's somebody who I'd like to take his advice on things, and so we have that connection for the rest of our lives that we got inducted together.
So you've been around the Hall of Fame for a bunch of years now since your induction, and now in this new role as president, you've gotten to spend time with all these fellow legends. I wonder if there is a common thread that you've noticed, or a quality that you seem to find that is shared by these elite champions and trainees around here.
I think talking to a lot of them, I think it's we love to win, but we hate to lose more. And I think that's probably a very common thread that a lot of them have is the hate you feel when you lose. And it can be a very destroying feeling, because it's, yeah, you work that out on yourself, and so you have to learn how to kind of, yeah, balance that and you know, those thoughts as well. Like, you have to be able to really learn to be kind to yourself, because in tennis, so much is based on, you know, win or lose, and that sometimes you forget that yourself. But I think that, yeah, a lot of us just hate to lose.
So do you remember more, or do you dwell more on the four Grand Slam finals that you won, or the four Grand Slam finals that you lost?
Well, they took longer to get over, right? But the wins are exciting, but the excitement goes away quicker, because there's the next goal right away. And then when you lose, it sticks with you, and it can stick into your head during the next matches. And so it's for me, it was definitely the losses that kind of made me push that up button on the treadmill a little bit harder and you know, said, oh no, let's not eat that cookie now, because it might be a difference maker in that next Grand Slam final one day. You know, like, it's that kind of thought, and you carry that with you.
A couple of years ago, you had another comeback, and it was limited by some injuries. Are you now that you've put that to bed, are you at full peace with having tennis behind you, or are there still some fires burning, or
No, definitely at full peace. Like I said, I do enjoy playing tennis very much still. It's it doesn't have to be on a show court at the Grand Slams, but I really enjoy playing tennis, and it started, you know, that feeling that I have for a sport is no different than when I started when I was 5 years old and was able to, you know, pick up some balls at my cousin's practice, and I enjoy it. I have no desire to come back on tour, but I do enjoy playing good tennis and to have a good workout and to compete so I will always have that in me, I think. Yeah.
What do you want the Kim Clijsters legacy to be?
That's a tough question, because it's a question that kind of gets asked a lot when when you're playing and they talk to you about, oh, you know, how does it feel to be a role model? And
you're so nice, Kim. She said everybody loves you, Kim. Is that?
Yeah.
What are we not seeing?
I don't know. I've never thought about it in that way.
No?
I don't think about my legacy. I just try to be the best. Like, I fell in love with the sport, and I've been passionate about playing tennis, and it is hard to find something that you're passionate about when you stop playing tennis that will give you that intense emotion, feeling of you know, setting goals and achieving them and failing at times, but then getting over that, and there's not much, or there's not going to be a lot of experience that will give me kind of that sensation again. And I remember a few years ago I went to lunch with two of my girlfriends, and you know, they're a few years older than me, but one is a psychologist, one is a physio, and they were saying, you know, you're so lucky, you've achieved all your dreams, and you've had so many dreams come through, but we are still trying to, you know, aim for those, and we're still working towards that. And I said, yeah, but it's, you know, I'm still young, like I was still in my mid-30s, and that doesn't mean that I have no more goals in my life or dreams that I would like to achieve. And so it's, you just have to shift and learn to maybe be a little softer on yourself. But for me, it was always very important to, like, be, you know, we get asked so many times, can you be the godmother of this project? Can you be an ambassador for this? And it's easy to lend your name to it, but I never felt comfortable if I couldn't be fully committed. And it's the same with my role in the Hall of Fame. I'm not doing it just to connect my name to something. Like, I want to be able to help, and because otherwise I'm not going to do it. And so I don't think about legacy. I am in the moment, and I try to create the best, you know, out of it, and how I can give back to a sport that has given me so many incredible, you know, feelings and memories.
I think you've already accomplished that. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
And in case you're wondering, yes, Kim Clijsters is every bit as nice as she sounds and appears. And she makes a great point at the end. The career of a top-level athlete starts earlier than the career of most of the rest of us, but it also ends earlier. While most professions see people peaking in their 50s or even 60s, athletes are often finished by 35 or 40, so it's great to see someone like Kim giving back to the sport that nourished her and which she graced by taking on this honorary role with the Hall of Fame. If you've missed any of the podcasts in this series, or even the 12 that made up Season 1, do go to tennisfame.com/podcast, where you'll find all of them. And please do tell your friends, family, and other associates about these interviews. Next time, we'll have a champion who got to number 2 in the world and who is now one of the leading tournament directors on the circuit, Tommy Haas. Don't miss that one. The Tennis Worthy Podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. I'm Brett Haber. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to tell your friends about these great interviews. We look forward to seeing you next time.